In 1962, at the dawn of the modern environmental movement, it was not climate change and global warming that was thought to be the most direct threat to life on Earth. Here's a passage from Rachel Carson's classic Silent Spring, the first public critique of pesticides. Quote, "How could intelligent beings seek to control a few unwanted species by a method that contaminated the entire environment and brought the threat of disease and death even to their own kind?" End quote. For much of her life, Rachel Carson was a struggling scientist who wrote to survive, supporting her mother and sisters after her father died in 1935. But the more she learned about the chemicals being dumped into the environment from industry and agriculture, the more her work became about survival of the entire planet. Quote, "Why should we tolerate a diet of weak poisons," she wrote, "a home in insipid surroundings, a circle of acquaintances who are not quite our enemies, the noise of motors with just enough relief to prevent insanity? Who would want to live in a world which is just not quite fatal?" Well, in the half century since Silent Spring was written, pollution has become the single largest cause of death in the developing world. Richard Fuller wants to change all that. He's the author of The Brown Agenda, My Mission to Clean Up the World's Most Life-Threatening Pollution. And he worries that the focus on global warming has taken some of the urgency out of the need to reverse pollution.
The issue here is, for us, about health, especially health impacting children. And a lot of these acutely contaminated places, which have grown in number so enormously over the last 20 or 30 years, as we've seen low and middle-income countries develop quite dramatically, the number of these sites and their impact has also just grown exponentially. It's now the single largest public health problem in the world. It far exceeds the public health problem of malaria or HIV or tuberculosis. In fact, it is a greater risk to health than those three combined times three. And if you break it down, someone dies because of pollution about every 4 seconds.
How much toxicity have you found that people tolerate in the places that you've visited? And what has really pushed your imagination of what human beings could actually live with or live near?
Well, we're very science-based. What we look to do is to implement programs that clean up places that are acutely toxic and significantly improve human health. Now, we only also work in places that are so extraordinarily polluted that if they were here in the U.S., they would be front-page news for months and months.
What kind of places and what is it like to be there?
We're working in one place right now in Africa called Kabwe. 200,000 people have been exposed to lead poisoning from an abandoned smelter that was operating since the early 1900s. And the lead safe level that's given out by US EPA and WHO is 5 micrograms per deciliter. Above about 60 micrograms per deciliter, you have a far increased chance of dying. But between 5 and 60, you have a lot of mental retardation, a lot of developmental disabilities, a lot of neurological damage from lead. The average blood lead level for kids in this particular town is about 75 micrograms right now. So you see a lot of people who are not very capable of doing much. Their output is severely restricted. Sometimes you see people who are digging in some of the waste piles who have severe neurological damage, and their eyes will shake and do funny things, and they'll pass out quite often from lead poisoning.
Who was responsible for the smelter, and is there any institutional responsibility or accountability to cleaning this up, aside from humanitarian work?
So the Zambian government's the key agency that really bears most of the responsibility, and it's them who are borrowing now from the World Bank to go out and fix and clean up this particular place. The polluter pays principle is absolutely the most fundamental rule in dealing with pollution. And generally we see that holding, except in places where the person who created the pollution is just bankrupt, terribly poor, and then the state can step in and help, or philanthropy can step in and help.
Among the entrepreneurial kinds of practices that you try to use to clean up brown sites is you create businesses in the local communities that are sustainable, that become a part of the cleanup. Can you describe how you've done that and who participates without actually compounding their levels of toxicity?
The majority of the pollution problems that show up out there, they're not very large international organizations necessarily. They're often local, small, or even artisanal activities. For example, people will be recycling car batteries and doing it in a way where they're not aware how toxic it is, but spreading the contaminants throughout their neighborhoods. So when they're shown alternate ways to be able to do this that are non-toxic, often they'll also need to find additional employment opportunities so they're not, their livelihoods are not damaged. For example, one cleanup that we did in Senegal, we brought in ways to help the women who were badly contaminated. In fact, many of their children died while they were just carrying them on their backs working to do this particular battery recycling effort. So we brought in activities that they could do that were alternate, ways for them to grow some market gardens, how to do sewing, taught them some of those sorts of things as well, just so that they still had jobs to continue with.
Would you say that the climate change debate has impeded the traditional debate and discussion over pollution? The original environmental laws related to pollution and not climate change, but now it seems to be reversed.
Yeah, it's really interesting because when the environment movement started in the U.S. with Silent Spring and Rachel Carson, the issue was biodiversity and pollution. And through that several decades of activity, we put a lot of effort into pollution here in the U.S., lots of great laws and institutions, and a lot of work into biodiversity with national parks and the like. There's much more to do, but we've generally done a pretty good job. Overseas, they have adopted the work that we've done in biodiversity, but they haven't adopted the pollution standard. And meanwhile, in the last couple of decades, climate change has taken over as the key environmental issue. So now we find that the agendas of these countries is biodiversity and climate change, and pollution has just simply dropped off the map. This is just an extraordinary result, and one we really need to turn around.
Richard Fuller is the author of The Brown Agenda, My Mission to Clean Up the World's Most Life-Threatening Pollution. He's also the founder and president of Pure Earth. Richard Fuller, thanks so much.
It's a great pleasure.